So in acknowledging these two traditions that we've been practicing with so much heart these last few days, I decided to give the talk a double name. So the talk this evening, honoring the 12 steps and the mindfulness Vipassana meditation in the Buddhist tradition, is called From the Gutter to Gratitude, Suffering and the End of Suffering. So for me, on September 17th in 1990, I survived barely my first day of sobriety from drugs and alcohol. I was 15 and a half years old. And reflecting on that day, I realized I don't really remember very much about it in terms of the particulars or how I even got through the day. I sort of remember going to school. I'm not quite sure if I stayed the whole day. I sort of even remember passing through an after-school job for a couple of hours, which totally boggles my mind. You know, perhaps too, for some of you, that first day of letting go of the addiction and moving out of it is a little hazy. But as I was reflecting, the one thing I do remember really clearly was the pain, you know? I remember the pain in my body, just the shakiness and the tension, you know, this heart, my heart just like a lead brick. And my mind just utter, you know, chaos, just a nightmare. In retrospect, I remember that. One thing I was really clear about at the time was that I was in pain, that it really hurt. But even more than that, I realized that any second I was going to have to face the deeper pain, because the pain I was in that day was kind of more of a survival mode. It was like, okay, body's, you know, detoxing a little bit and mind is chaos and just that first day of sobriety. But for me, one of the primary reasons that I did all the things that I did with addiction was to kind of soothe and put a Band-Aid over the deeper pain in my life, particularly in my family life. So I remember that. I was reflecting on that. And then I was reflecting on, you know, the founders of our great tradition of 12 steps and how they so clearly named that. They called it by its true name, you know, and it's the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, you know, that our lives had become unmanageable. Just naming that pain. And then I was reflecting on the Buddha, 2,500 years before the founders of AA came to that teaching. And he had a real similar teaching to that first step. Much more universal explanation of it. And just very simply, you know, in life there is suffering, is what he said. And it's the first of what is called the Four Noble Truths. So tonight what I want to attempt to do is to bring these two traditions together, because I feel like if the Buddha was going to offer 12 steps, you know, he would have offered it in the form of the Four Noble Truths. It was the first teaching that he taught to his small group of friends on the spiritual path once he became fully enlightened. And he almost didn't do it. He wasn't sure whether anybody would get it. Kind of similar to, you know, Bill and all them weren't really sure that any other alcoholics were going to get these steps. They sort of started bringing people in, and is anybody going to get this? Is this going to work? But the Buddha decided to offer it because he had an intuition, or really a clear seeing, that there were those with little dust in their eyes, is how it's said. And thank goodness he did that, because, you know, for 2,500 years, people have been now able to receive these teachings of naming suffering and the end of suffering. And thank goodness the founders of AA did it, because none of us would be here if they hadn't, among other things. So bringing these two together, the Four Noble Truths, actually, if you look at them, have 12 steps. They have 12 parts. There's the Four Noble Truths, and then the Fourth Noble Truth has 8 parts. So we've got these two 12-step traditions, if you'll indulge me a little bit in bringing these two together. They both have a lot to teach me, and I think to teach us. They're both the 12 steps and the Four Noble Truths, they're a teaching, they're a powerful teaching, but more importantly, they're a practice. Because we could hear either one and go, yeah, good idea. And if we don't practice them, we're going to stay in that gutter of suffering. They both really bear witness to the suffering that we experience. They both offer practices to alleviate it and end the suffering. I find that often the 12 steps work on a more personal level, which is really important. You know, my story, our stories. The Four Noble Truths have the capacity to work on what I like to call a universal level. Because what's interesting in trying to bring these two together for this talk is that, you know, we do have this disease, this addiction. It's very real. But the roots of it are common in all humanity. No one is without. So it's an interesting dance that these two play. So the way the Four Noble Truths are laid out, the way the Buddha laid them out, is kind of like a doctor. So the First Noble Truth is like the diagnosis of the disease. In life, there is suffering. I don't think any of us is going to argue with that. I like that interpretation better than life is suffering, which is another way that we'll sometimes hear it, because it tends to make our minds just stay in one place, like, you know, it's all suffering. In life there is suffering, period. And then we think, well, what about the joy? And it's very clear, you know, what about the peace? As we move through these Four Noble Truths, that's totally a part of it. So in life there is challenge, in life there is suffering. We know this. We've all directly experienced this. So when the Buddha talked about suffering, he tended to talk about the suffering of birth. Certainly it probably wasn't pleasant to come through that birth canal. Probably most of us don't remember, but it seems to make some sense that that wouldn't have been entirely pleasant. And then there's the suffering of sickness. So, you know, there's the suffering of just colds and flus and illnesses and whatnot. And then, of course, I'm sure he would include the suffering of our disease of addiction. Absolutely. There's the suffering of aging, which really starts the minute we're born. You know, we're born, we're babies, we're aging into children, we're aging into teenagers, we're aging into adults, middle age, and older age, and just all of the letting go that comes with that. You know, all that we have to let go of as we go through each stage of life, and we grieve that, you know, these precious things that we love, and then they change as our bodies change and grow older, as our minds change and grow older and wiser. And then, of course, death is included in this list of suffering. And, you know, for a lot of us, We probably, some of us probably have some very close relationships with death, the idea of death, coming close to death, doing the dance with death. We know it's part of it is painful. You know, maybe not all of it is painful, but there is some suffering there. One of my teachers, Sylvia Boorstein, has this quote that I really like. She says it all the time. She says, you know, it's heroic to be a human being living a life. It's heroic. And I love how she worded that, because she didn't say we're heroes to be humans and leading a life. So it's like, I'm the hero. She said it's heroic, that we're all in this heroic act of being a human being, living a life. It's certainly a heroic act to do what we're doing, our practices of waking up and being present. So how this first truth connects to 12 steps, and I'll really only have time this evening to just give a couple reflections on each of these. I realized I could probably give a whole series of talks, but this is one talk, so. That first step, you know, just the suffering of being powerless before we know the end of suffering, about being powerless. The unmanageability of our lives, they're just, you know, when we're caught in addiction, it's out of control and it's painful, really painful. And then the other thing I think of is the fourth step. You know, when I think about the first time I did the fourth step, it was so painful. I couldn't believe the harm that, you know, that I had done to others, to myself. There's so much suffering. It's just very, very painful. So I think of that too. It's like, yeah, in life there's suffering. In life, I have caused harm. I have been harmed. Yeah. So that's kind of the diagnosis part. The second noble truth is the cause. So where did the disease come from? And what the Buddha said, again to us, no surprise, the cause of suffering is a Pali word. It's called tangha. And if Kevin and I haven't explained in this retreat yet, Pali is the language that the Buddha's teachings were translated into after they were passed along orally for several hundred years. So that's the Pali language. So this tangha, what it means? Craving. The cause of suffering is craving. We know this. The cause of suffering is also said to be, you know, to clinging. This grasping, this forward motion, this I have to have that drink right now or I'm not going to make it through the next 5 minutes. You know, or I'm just feeling really lonely, and if I had this kind of food, maybe I'd feel better. This craving, I won't say any more about it. We know it, we're friends with it, we're intimate with it. So where does it come from? We've all explored this in our 12-step work. What is this craving? Where does it come from? What is its nature? We need to know it so that we can stay out of our addiction in our behaviors. So what the Buddha talked about, which for me was really useful for reflections, fundamentally, we're craving, we're wanting things to be different from how they are. So something's happening, we want it to be different. And I was kind of thinking about the steps, and I was just thinking about how it works. And I think how it works in the Big Book has a really deep relationship with the Four Noble Truths. So I was thinking about the lines that said, you know, when we're first introduced to the steps, and it's like, okay, this is really big. You know, at some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. We wanted it to be different. I mean, how many of us thought, okay, you know, I'm powerless over food, or I'm powerless over sex, or I'm powerless over whatever I'm powerless over, you know, but I kind of want the steps to be different. Like, could I turn it over to something else? Or, you know, do I have to come to believe? Maybe I could just go to the moral inventory. You know, and then we get to the moral inventory and it's like, do I really have to do that moral inventory? I'd love it to be different. Maybe I could just apologize to a few people and that would be enough. You know, we want the step practice to be different. You know, and sometimes, of course, we fall in love with the steps, and that's fine too, but there's these layers of resistance of wanting things to be different than how they are. You know, and then, of course, just in our lives, you know, we're walking through these lives totally committed to not acting out on our addictions, and our family is driving us up the wall. And we're annoyed, and if only they'd stop making that noise, and if only they would stop telling me that thing, and if only my kids would stop whining right now, then I'd be happy, you know? If only it were different, then I'd be okay. So this wanting things to be different, and you know, when we reflect, it goes on forever. We want our meditation practice to be different. You know, we were calm, we had some mindfulness, but we didn't have an insight. And if only we'd had an insight, you know, then we wouldn't be suffering. Just a really typical example. Also, this desire and aversion that Kevin talked about last night plays right into this, and those are kind of flip sides of the coin, the wanting, you know, I really want that dessert, and I really don't want that dessert, you know, which is a different kind of dessert. I really want the ice cream and I really don't want the cake. I really want, you know, that person in the meeting that is going on forever and ever to stop talking, and, you know, they won't. It just goes on forever, this wanting and aversion and wanting and aversion. We just go back and forth, you know. And us with our habituated extreme minds, sometimes we take it to extremes. You know, we start hating things and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger in our minds until like everything is horrible. You know, it starts out with like, I hate this traffic, and it goes to like, you know, I hate this country, and why are we like this in this country? I mean, it just gets very, very large. And the wanting, of course, we know does the same thing. This is cause of suffering. Another piece is just the fact, Kevin talked about it last night too, that everything's changing. So we get really comfortable in our lives and we've got it just right so that, you know, our work is satisfying and our family is, you know, not too dysfunctional, and our friends are listening to us and telling us we're great, and our sobriety seems pretty solid. I mean, you know, we can all start laughing at that point. Our sobriety seems pretty solid. And then out of nowhere we slip. Where did it come from? It changed. Out of nowhere, you know, we lost our job. We lost our house. You know, just because we're not acting out these addictions in the same way doesn't mean that our lives become perfect. You know, we know this, and things change and we grieve because it's loss, and we grieve, and it's painful. And again, we all know this. This is not like esoteric secret teachings. They're really practical, just like the 12 steps are. One little saying that I've been saying to myself almost continuously, especially in daily life in the last year, came to me on a retreat, I don't know, a year or so ago. It's just this: conditions are not ideal. They rarely are. Conditions are not ideal. They rarely are. Because I don't know about you, but I get caught sometimes in these cycles of thinking that if I get it just right, like, I've done it, you know? I haven't turned it over. I've done it. And then when conditions aren't ideal, it's like, oh, I messed up. What happened? You know, I must not have done it right. It's like, no, actually, you know, conditions sometimes aren't ideal. And in fact, they really rarely are perfectly ideal. That perfection, that perfect sobriety, that perfect meditation is just, you know, rare and far in between. And we bow like crazy when it arises. It's like, yeah, let's celebrate. It's totally real and important. And when it passes, conditions aren't ideal again. You know, it's still okay. So just for me, tracking, is it still okay? Can it still be okay? These causes of suffering. So the third noble truth we could call the cure, for lack of a better word. There's a couple different ways I've heard it articulated. One of them is there is an end to suffering. There's an end to suffering, it's the cure. I like Sylvia Boorstein's interpretation actually the best, and it's very homey and down to earth and just really practical and workable. She just says the third noble truth is peace is possible. And I reflect on that all the time. Peace is possible. Just as I offered in the meditation instruction this morning, invite peace now. Peace is possible. So on a fundamental level, the third noble truth is talking about the possibility of full awakening. It's talking about the possibility of enlightenment, you know, which is totally possible. And while that's important for me to keep in my heart and in my practice, on a day-to-day level, practicing with peace as possible gives me a little more to work with, because not enlightened yet here, you know, nor are any of us. And I also have a lot of faith that as awake as each of us are going to get in our lifetime, the conditions in some ways are already set up. And if we just practice with sincerity and, you know, do our program and practice being present however we do it, we're going to wake up as much as we're going to wake up. You know, that's all we have to do. We don't have to do more than that. So this peace is possible. The key for it for me is peace is possible without things having to be different. So I don't have to go back to when I was born and say, oh, well, you know, if I wasn't an alcoholic, then peace would be possible. I don't have to do that. I can be a recovering alcoholic and peace is still possible. I don't have to get rid of or even have removed all of my character defects to have peace possible. I can be totally human and still have peace possible, as can we all. So when I think about, you know, making the decision to turn it over to a higher power, that's the first thing I think of with peace as possible, that feeling that we've all had when we really turn it over. It's a mystery. It's a mystery how that happens or when it happens, but when it happens, there's peace. There's that letting go. Ajahn Chah, who Kevin read some of his teachings the first night, he's a Thai forest master and a teacher of our teachers, has this great saying that I love to say to myself often. He says, if you let go a little, you have a little peace. And if you let go a lot, you have a lot of peace. And if you let go completely, you have complete peace. And it always makes me smile, and you know, I see some of you smiling. There's something about that that we resonate with. These layers of the onion of letting go. You know, we don't work the steps once, we work them 1.5 million times. And that letting go and that release and that peace just keeps getting sweeter and sweeter and sweeter as we keep practicing the steps. And we know this. And so for me, that's where these two come together. I also like the teaching from Ajahn Buddhadasa, who is another Thai forest master. And he talks about something called Nibbana for everyone. So Nibbana is the Pali word for enlightenment. He says, you know, Nibbana for everyone. And he would teach monks and nuns. He would also teach lay people. And he would talk about moments of awakening. So it's easy to think in Buddhist practice, you know, that there is this whole path, and eventually it culminates in full enlightenment, and maybe someday all of us will get there, and, you know, eventually, in the spans of time, I'm sure all of us will. But what Ajahn Buddhadasa likes to talk about is Nibbana for everybody, these moments of awakening, and to acknowledge them, that they are awakening, these moments of turning it over, these moments of, you know, humbly asking to have that which obscures our wisdom removed. These are moments, these are little mini moments of enlightenment. Not to get big heads, any of us, you know, it's like, I'm enlightened. It's not about that, it's just these moments of peace. So that's the cure practice. The fourth noble truth is kind of like the path of treatment. It's called the Eightfold Path. And it's practical tools to add to our tool chest of practices. An easy way to break them down is into three parts. And the first part, which includes three steps, or three, I tend to call them steps, to be honest, three parts of the Eightfold Path, is called Sila. And Sila is really referring to cleaning house. It's really, if we're connecting them to 12-step practice, you know, probably steps 4 through 9 is Sila. What it is wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. So these are components of our life that we all are probably pretty clear that we need to practice with in order to stay clear, to stay present. This wise speech we talked about in the Insight Dialogue, I talked about it as Buddha's instructions for wise speech, the short version anyway, is speech that's truthful. Okay, so we all know about this rigorous honesty. Speech that's timely. You know, when to make that amends, when to do the fifth step to share our moral inventory with another person. Timing's important, you know. Speech that doesn't divide people. So when we're, you know, making a ninth step amends, can we do it in a way that doesn't alienate either us or the person that we're making amends to? It's a way to bring this wise speech into the 12 steps. Wise action fits in there too. You know, when to take the action of actually sitting down and starting to write that inventory. When to make the action to call our sponsor or the friend that's, you know, going to bear witness to our suffering, really. You know, the action of going into, how to go into stores to make amends for taking that which wasn't given when we were still using or into other addictive behaviors. You know, how do we go about doing that? What's our wise action? So we're already doing this in 12 steps. It's just, I'm saying it to make the connection between that and our mindfulness practice. Wise livelihood, for me, simple way to think about it is actually is 12 step. How we share this with other people who, you know, are either suffering with addiction or new in recovery. How do we share it? What kind of service are we doing? What kind of commitments are we making and following through on? You know, we may not be making a quote-unquote living on it, but what the Buddha said for wise livelihood was just, you know, actions in the world for livelihood that don't cause harm, that are offering something to others, you know, as well as, I'm sure, to ourselves. So this wise livelihood. So that's the first three steps, the sila, this house cleaning. The second chunk is another three steps, and it's called samadhi. The translation of samadhi is usually translated as concentration. So the three steps are wise effort, wise mindfulness and wise concentration. So for wise effort, I like to think about, again, going back to how it works, spiritual progress over spiritual perfection. We know that we have to put effort into our recovery. It doesn't just happen by itself. But we know that if we beat ourselves up, we're just setting a cycle of destructiveness that's going to lead to pain that might cause us to go back into the other behaviors. So it's the middle path of wise effort. And going back to that spiritual progress over spiritual perfection has been really helpful for me. For the mindfulness, just really simply, honesty. You know, naming what's true as we move through all the steps. Every step has a naming quality, a naming what's true. And that's really what mindfulness is. It's like we forget, and then we remember. The remembering is a moment of mindfulness. You know, we get caught in our addictive delusion and, you know, get caught in resentment. And then we wake up, and it's like, oh, you know, instant inventory. You know, going to 10th step, continuing to take that personal inventory. Oh yeah, I'm wrong. Okay, I'm naming it. I'm admitting it promptly. You know, this is true, this resentment. It's all mindfulness. And with the concentration, I think whatever prayer and meditation practice that we take on develops that calm and focus that comes with concentration. There's not one way to develop a steadiness of experience and a steadiness of mind. So whatever range of things we work with the 11th step, you know, from any kind of prayer or meditation, when we give ourselves to it fully and really bring in our sincerity and energy, it's concentration arises. You know, it doesn't have to be, sometimes it is a heroic effort, but it doesn't have to be. So that's the samadhi piece. There's two more steps, and it's the panya piece. Panya is the Pali word for wisdom. So it's the wisdom piece. And the first one's wise intention. And I think the 12 steps are nothing if not intention. You know, starting with coming to believe in a power higher than ourselves, it's like, you know, that moment of faith, there's an intention there. There's an intention to let faith arise. You know, when we turn it over in the third step, it's not like we go, okay, turn it over and then it's just done. We're setting an intention to turn our will and our lives over to a higher power. And then we don't know how the intention's going to manifest or when, or, you know, it does. It does. You know, we set intention in the sixth and seventh step with the character defects. We're setting intention again and again and again. And then the last step is this wise understanding. And if I was going to use 12-step language, I would say practicing these principles in all our affairs. You know, wise understanding of, for the Four Noble Truths, is wise understanding of each of the pieces of the Four Noble Truths and practicing it. For the 12 steps, it's understanding the 12 steps and practicing it. You know, again, how it works, it's like rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed this path. Is really relevant to this wise understanding, following this path, being committed. So, having moved through these, and having practiced these, both sets of these teachings for me, and they just weave in and out. One of the things I love and really appreciate about having two practices that I've spent a number of years doing is that they just come together. There's an ease with which one informs the other and back and forth, and they don't have to be these two separate things that I do anymore. And there's a healing there. There's a healing because we live these lives that are compartmentalized, you know. I do my exercise here, and I have my food here, and my work is separate from my family, and my spiritual practice is separate from my meetings, and we live these compartmentalized lives. So I think the more that we can allow all of our parts of our lives and all of our practices to come together, there's a healing there. So for me, I just come back to gratitude. And just remembering in the meeting last night that we had, I can't remember right the second who said it, but it reminded me of just how many times I've heard in the rooms, I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm grateful to be sober today. I'm grateful to be able to breathe this breath, and here it is, and I was there for it. Just this gratitude. This gratitude, it's gratitude for the end of suffering. So, to close, I'd just like to share this poem by W.S. Merwin. And it's a poem that really bears witness and honors suffering and the end of suffering, the gutter and the gratitude. And it's called We Say Thank You. Listen. With the night falling, we are saying thank you. We are stopping on the bridge to bow from the railings. We are running out of the glass rooms with our mouths full of food to look at the sky and say thank you. We are standing by the water looking out in different directions. Back from a series of hospitals, back from a mugging, after funerals, we are saying thank you. After the news of the dead, whether or not we knew them, we are saying thank you. In a culture up to its chin in shame, living in the stench that it has chosen, we are saying thank you. Over telephones, we are saying thank you. In doorways and in the backs of cars and in elevators, remembering wars and the police at the back door and the beatings on the stairs, we are saying thank you. In the banks that use us, we are saying thank you. With the crooks in office, with the rich and fashionable, unchanged, we go on saying thank you. Thank you. With all the animals dying around us, our lost feelings, we are saying thank you. With the forest falling faster than the minutes of our very lives, we are saying thank you. With the words going out like cells of a brain, with the cities growing over us like the earth, we are saying thank you. Faster and faster, with nobody listening, we are saying thank you. We are saying thank you. And waving, dark though it is. Dark though it is. So, this great meeting, this great intimacy between the gutter and the gratitude, that we would not have the great gratitude that we sometimes feel without that gutter. That we would not taste the sweetness of the end of suffering if we had not suffered so deeply. The Buddha talks about the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. And I love that because I understand it. It's like, we know that everything that we went through before we came out of our addiction has led us to everything that we're experiencing now, both the pain and the peace. So this poem really reflects that. We are saying thank you. We're saying thank you for the pain. We're saying thank you for the pain that's led us to the awakeness, to the aliveness that we're able to experience now with less addiction, without addiction. Dark though it is, So let's just sit for a minute.